Hi, it's Monday evening, and I want to take a very busy week, so I want to take this opportunity to look at something I haven't paid much attention to in the podcast so far this summer, and it's Pirkei Avos for Mishpacha Stefanski. Thank you very much to B'Tzalel Stefanski and family for their constant sponsorship and support. And as I say, I haven't taken a look at Pirkei Avos, and this week I just looked it up. I'm not even following it myself. Is the fourth parak dalid. That's what it says. And I want to call attention to a few points. You know, the way I like to do it, to Mishnah Charayin, a little bit of history together with, or an attempt to discover the historical context of sayings in the Pirkei Avos. You can't always do it, but let me put it this way. There's always a historical context. Nobody says something for nothing. Okay, get that in your head. Not a Tana, not a Mora, not anybody. Nobody says something for nothing. There's a reason for it. In the Chumash, maybe, okay, since it's divine and so forth, so it's beyond historical context, although even there is the historical context, but that doesn't cover the totality of the meanings. But if you're talking about a statement made by some person, then it was always said because something happened or some reason provoked it, because you don't just wake up in the morning and say, It's not Captain Kangaroo or something like that. So let's take a look at Pirkei Avos, the fourth parak, and I see a couple of very interesting things. I made a note or two to myself, and I'll jump around, not in any particular order. And right away, I see the Rabbi Tzadok says, Al tifrish min hatzibur. Rabbi Tzadok says, don't be porish min hatzibur. Don't separate yourself from the community. Which is one of the big things. You look at the Rambam, that's one of the things that's Ma'akev Teshuvah, and so on and so forth. Al tifrish min hatzibur, Rabbi Tzadok. Why would Rabbi Tzadok make a statement like that? This actually has to do with Tisha B'Av, and I'll tell you where I'm coming from. Everybody knows the story. Maybe you forget who said it. The Rabbi Tzadok fasted for 40 years that Yerushalayim should not fall. This is in the famous Kamsa Bar Kamsa Gemara that we all are familiar with when it comes to Gittin. And to tell you the truth, it's about Beitar. According to the Gemara, it's Yerushalayim, right? Yeah, it's Yerushalayim. Why do I say that? Because Yochim and Zacha, when he ran away to the Romans and was received by them, he asked for three things, and one of them was a doctor to cure Abtzadik. Remember that? A doctor to cure Abtzadik. Because he's so skinny that you couldn't eat, he'll kill you. Unless you're in a highly supervised medical regimen. And the Romans supplied him with a highly supervised medical regimen. We know this is true from my father's generation. How many Jews and others died after the liberation from the Germans by the Americans, the Russians, and the British, especially the Americans? Because the Americans, with the best intentions in the world, all came loaded with chocolates and cigarettes and candies and food and all kind of stuff. There never was an army that was as well stuffed and well supplied as the U.S. Army in World War II. I mean that. In fact, there's a very, very good book for those that are interested in this arcane subject. I still remember her name, Lizzie Collingham, I think, if I remember correctly, about the food as a part of the history of World War II. It was very good. Lizzie Collingham, I think that's what her name was. Why it sticks in my head. Came out in the last 10 years, something like that. And you know how each of the combating armies and countries dealt with the food issues. For example, just off the top of my head, I remember, you know, in the Pacific when the Americans fought the Japanese, so they did island hopping. In other words, there were whole islands with large Japanese garrisons, and the Americans simply went around them and captured islands farther closer to Japan and left these guys to stay there. And they blockaded them, and they ran out of food. And many of them died, the Jap soldiers. And those who survived when the war was over, and they had surrendered when Japan surrendered, they said the men looked like toothpicks. You know what I'm saying? So that's the Japanese. What about the 6 million Jews, or rather the survivors of the 6 million Jews, like my father? He was skin and bones. I forget, I think 80 pounds he weighed. It was crazy. And it's very dangerous to eat. So the Romans supplied him, and they did what you do nowadays, which is the first day you give a, and second day two times, and three times, very slow regimen, a little bit of nourishment, then a little bit more nourishment, and slowly but surely, as we would say today, you expand the stomach, I suppose, and the nutrition in a healthy way. So that's Rabbi Tzadok. Now ask yourself the following question, which I bet you never did. Why did Reb Tzadik do that? So he said, well, what do you mean he's a Tzadik? He was worried about Yerushalayim. He could see the city's going to fall. And he was praying that it shouldn't happen. And et cetera, et cetera. I get it. How come nobody else did? Why didn't Yochanan Zakkai do that? He lived in a time of all the Tanoim, the early ones. And, right? True? You know, it was the time of 70 AD. A few years later, it was already the Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Tarfon. They didn't come out of nowhere. So they were around at that time. If he had big tzaddikim, and we're talking about Tanoim over here, so how come, Rabbi Tzadik is the only one that did it? Maybe because I don't know. That's a statement of fact. But isn't it interesting that he says a principle, it's recorded in Pirkei Avos, Al Tefresh Min HaTzibur. Now, what does that mean? He was an old rabbi, as you know, and they were fighting the Romans. Okay, I get it. And he wasn't a combatant. He couldn't fight. He said, that's true. 100% true. But I'll do what I can. I'll do what I can. What I can do is daven and fast. To the point that he wasted himself away, that it required emergency medical treatment. But he, notice he was mishtate with the tzibur. It's, you get it? And the others didn't do it. I don't know why. Maybe it's part of, I'm speculating, maybe it's part of sinas chinam. Maybe it's because they figured the people in the city don't deserve it. Or maybe, they were so wrapped up in the partisan fighting over there, which it was extraordinarily fierce, as you know, very sadly, from Josephus and from the Agadatos that you find in Kamsa Bar Kamsa and other places like that. The Jews killed each other by the buckets. I don't know why the others didn't undertake to, and I'm not really being fair. It takes a certain type of personality to say, I'm going to fast for 40 years and this is my way of participating. But he's not. But the reason he did it wasn't simply because he's a tzaddik. The others are tzaddik also. He figured this way he's not punishment at Zibur. That's what it seems to me. So in other words, the modern equivalent, and I'm going to say something that's sad now, is, as I said 100 times, you have a problem in Israel with drafting the B'nai Torah and all the rest, as we know, goes on and on. One of the worst aspects of the whole thing is the bad blood. In other words, you see so many of the Haredim that say, the heck with the army, and the heck with Israel, and the heck with all the rest of the Tzionim are all Apikursim anyway, and the state goes down, it'll be their own fault, and all the rest of it. Instead of saying, we're learning for you. You get it? Maybe, this is just my opinion. Maybe if the from world gave off a kind of an appearance of, we're not punishment at Sibur. You fight with the military side, and we fight with the learning side. Now, it's not going to satisfy the parents of kids who are in the army, like the Kipas Roga. And I understand it. And believe me, I completely understand it. And I sympathize with that. But at least it would take off the chill, so to speak. At least they would say, all right, but we're all in it together. Maybe me and this Haredi guy disagree on how best to serve the cause. But we both believe in serving the cause. As opposed to, heck with your cause. Right? You're following a bad bankrupt leadership and we are not gurus it whatsoever. Maybe the Chachamim in the time of the Korban Beis HaMikdash were like that. You guys, the Biryonim and the others who don't listen to us and are leading everybody to destruction, we don't have nothing to do with you. As opposed to Reb Tzadok, we see experientially, empirically I should say, he didn't take that point of view. Now I bet you he also saw that it's not a good situation. They say in the Gemara that he foresaw the Korban, he tried to push it off. If he foresaw the Korban, he saw the terribly dysfunctional state of Jewish political affairs in Roman Judea and Jerusalem at the time of the war of 67 to 70 CE. I get it. But at least he said, let me go. And he said he faced it for 40 years. So I want you to think about that. If you take that literally, then if the Korban was in the year 70, he started facing in the year 30. Right? 40 years. What was happening in the year 30? I mean, it was the time of Pontius Pilate and so forth. That's a long time. And so, he is a Tana and all the rest of it. And obviously, he must have eaten a Grogris Reb Tzadik a tiny, tiny, tiny bit. And he participated in the debates in the Sanhedrin and all. Because you see in the Gemara, sometimes there are halachas from Reb Tzadik. But he's not Parshman at Sibur. He did this while he's fasting. So it's a little bit like, it's not exactly the same thing, But still, like if you ask the question, what are you here in America, for example, or at Kutzlars, doing, how you perish or not perish from the tzibur? What are you doing, mishtatev in the tzar klal Yisrael at this moment? There's a klal Yisrael that hang a lot of tzar. There are people being killed as we speak now, unfortunately, in Gaza and in other places. Like, we know that. We know it. Okay? What are you doing about it, right? So maybe you're not over there fighting and maybe not in Israel and all the rest. I understand that. So how are you being doing it? I read in the art scroll, Mendelovich's book, you know, Shagavai Mendelovich, that he, if I remember correctly, that he did not eat fleishigs during the Second World War. As his personal chumra. I don't know if it's true, but I'm just telling what I read. And that's Altifer Shminitz. If it's true, and for Shragafai Manish, I totally believe it. He had that type. That was his way of Altifer Shminitz Ibur. What did others do? So you say, I guess, I give tzedakah. Okay. I daven for them. We say a couple kapitel to Tehillim and all the rest of it. I mean, I hear that. And let me tell you something. That's at least a minimal level. So if you're in a shul and they're saying kapitel for Israel, you're not going to say that you do. He took it farther. So Altifer Shminitz Tzibur, if he is presented as the spokesman for that theory, Altifer Shminitz Tzibur, I would suggest that it's because he did it in such an outstanding way, in his own goof, that he lived a life of radical ascetism on behalf of the klal, and that's unusual. Therefore, he's mentioned in the Perkei Avos. So what I'm trying to say is like this. I'm sure many people said Altifer Shminitz Tzibur. And is mentioned in some other context in the Shas, if you know. But he's the one associated with, as the archetype, you might say, of this approach. And it's very, very interesting. Now, this has to do with the broader question, at least to my mind, of what was the result of the Korban? Because I just told you, he said, don't be Pershman and Zebra, but many others were. And you may perhaps recall the Yerushalmi that says that Beitar was destroyed later on because they were happy at the destruction of Jerusalem because the people in Jerusalem used to screw them over financially. So in other words, yeah, but they weren't. But you can't be Pershman at Tzibur. Not when the Tzibur is under attack. You see, that's not the time to do that. That's the time to show up. Plenty of time for Machlokes later, but now, when times are tough, that's the time to show up and stand up and be counted. At least say, I support this team. At least say, I support this team. That's just very interesting. And by the way, you don't see too much anymore because the war in Gaza goes on and on. And unfortunately, I'm very sad that you don't see Tehillim gatherings, all the rest of it so much. But at least those are expressions where we're not punished from the Tzibur. Now, you can be cynical and say it's easy to stand in some city and Chutzlarts and say Tehillim. I get that, but at least you're not saying, I have nothing to do with this, okay? Doesn't affect me, Tomalai, now she, all the rest of it. Now, did the Churban, now I'm talking today, right after Tu B'Av, the week after Tisha B'Av, did the Churban affect the mindset of the Jews in Israel afterwards? It's interesting because, let me put it this way, as far as I can tell, depends how you understand this. The rabbis, knows the Talmid Chachamim, after the Churban, if what I read is true, kind of learned the lesson of the Sinas Chinam, okay? But that doesn't mean that the average Hamon Am did so. And what do I mean? We all know the famous story of Reb Zera, in the Moran Bab Mitzia, very famous, that he fasted in order to forget what he learned in Bubble. So Rabbi Zera was an Amora from Bavel, who came up the Babylonian system, and was already an Amora then, so think of what that means. And then he made Aliyah, and moved to Israel with all kinds of adventures, and one of the things he did over there was, now I'm entering the Israeli yeshiva system. So the American system is not that different than the Israeli system, but Israelis would laugh at me and say, oh, you're wrong, right? You're saying you're wrong. Ain't Torah says Israel, and so forth. I get it. What's the key point? Why did he so he says, it's so the truth of the matter is a matter of girsas, but I'm going with the standard old-fashioned, regular, you know, rusty, trusty girsa, that it says he fasted. The language in the Pirkei Avos I have, the Ein Yaakov in front of me, is Rabbi Zera kisolik l'aretz Eretz Yisrael, where Rabbi Zera made Aliyah and moved to Israel. Yosef mea tanisa, he fasted 100 days, The Lishkach Talmud of Babylon Minei, to forget what he learned in the Babylonian Talmud. See, one of the clear mind. Why? You learned, you were an Amora. So why do you want to forget what you learned in Babel? Or to be more exact, Lishkach Talmuda Bavlo Amine. The language is a little ambiguous. We could play with this. Doesn't say he fasted to forget what he learned, but to forget the Talmud Bavlo. So Rashi says, Kesha'ol Eretz Yisrael, Lilma Pi Rabbi Yochanan, the Rav Zeira made Aliyah and moved to Israel to learn by Rabbi Yochanan. Amaraim Sheb Eretz Yisrael, Lo Haya B'nei Machlekes. Rashi says this. Then at the time over here, to the 3rd century, so the time of Rabbi Yochanan, they weren't B'nei Machlekes. V'nochin Zeh L'Zeh Kishmon, Kishemen, I guess. And they were Machniah one to the other. In other words, they made it their business to be civil and to get along and be friendly, even when they disagreed. We're not saying over here, in order to be friendly and civil, you have to agree. You have to learn how to disagree agreeably. That's the point. You know what I said? You have to learn how to disagree agreeably. Can I read the Sanhedrin? Umiyashvin is a time and below Kushit's Aprukim. And they're able to be Yashiv the halachas, that's what he means over there, without all these kashas and trutzim. What does that mean? It's a very famous marsha I've spoken about before. And again, I'm just looking at the Ein Yaakov, the marsha over there on the side. And what do you mean you learn without kashas and trutzim? That's what the Talmudic process is, through dialectics. So Havvade, the marsha says, the Gambanei is Yisrael Maksha Mefarket Adodi. In Israel also, whatever the yeshiva system was, they also had questions and answers. I mean, kashas and trutzim. No, they employed dialectics. You say this, I have a contradiction over here, and we resolve it through the synthesis. That's what that's the meat and potatoes of Shas. Ken Amrina Le'il, Rabbi Yochanan Gufi Nemra Rish Lakish Makshi Chavta Al Kush and Barkin Chavta Al Perugi. The Rabbi Yochanan himself, who Rashi says Rabbi Zeir was coming to learn under, used to ask 24 kashas and Rish Lakish give him 24 answers or something. So they had kashas and trutzim. El Hain, by the way, that's interesting. Zeir would ask 24 kashas. I remember I was, forget who, Rashi ben Israel, I was once visiting. Maybe it was Rabbi Scheinberg. And he asked, you know, he asked questions. And then you take it from the audience, see what kind of answers they give. El Dahainu Shayim Ma'ainim Esan Kol Davar Aburya. But rather, what it means is they were intellectually honest. And they were Ma'ainim, and they fixed everything to make it clear. Every halachic issue, Hashmu Yotzes Lori De Populim. And the Shmua came out to light, meaning they reached the correct interpretation of the law through a process of give and take and dialectics, but not almanas lakantir, not just to score points against the other person, but in an honest search for the truth by dialectical reasoning. It says this, what about that? Then we come up with an answer, let's test the answer to see if it works, and so forth. Darochi Maisali Hosam Rishlokajokar Ham Kharb Tuba, Hamachava Miyashiv Dibri. Rabbi Meir, that even the one who was asking kashas was mechavev, what Rabbi Meir said, dali de pupulim rab chashmaitza, and through that kind of dialectic, you have intellectual progress. Mashen came b'nei bavel, whereas in the yeshivas of bavel suggests the marshal living as the number one Rosh Yeshiva in the first half of the 17th century in Poland, where he was like the king. Maybe they learned the lumdus like today, like we have now in Poland, which is the chalukim and the pulpulim of Yaakov Pollock and all that, in which you ask 25 questions and you give 25 answers, but you split it in half and you double it again, and you one teretz answers 55 kashas and so forth. Asher kol misha yudei lechav nasei yosef a pilpul shel hevel. The more you are able to impress people with pilpul shel hevel. Now, shooting the bowl, harayzim meshubach, v'kolechem mechavim lidchas de mechaveiro, and each one is trying to slug up the other person instead of an honest search for the truth, in which you say, you know, your answer is better than mine. Nobody said that. Kidakarli mechablim, they're like terrorists. Shem anochin zeba alocha, v'aydezah lo sech l'shalik dehilkasa, and therefore it doesn't come out the correct answer, but rather I say this in Hilchos Shabbos, you disagree with me. And you say something else in Hilchos Shabbos, and I'll move heaven and earth to prove that my teretz is right and yours is wrong. Even though if I was honest about it and I thought about it, I'd say, you know, his answer is better than mine. His answer is better than mine. So, and so on and so forth. So, if this is true, then it seems that the rabbis, at least, who are the ones who said that Bais Sheni was destroyed because of Sinas Chinim, at least took it to heart, the way it's being described over here, and at least in learning, applied this business of no Sinas Chinim as best as possible. Best as possible. So, we do have the story of Elazar, and we do have the story of Shimon ben Yochai and others, but you do have those, right? I'm sorry, Elazar and some of the others, where they had these big fights, remember Gamliel, but it seems to be that the Chachomim, I'm talking about the Tanoim now, Namroim, had learned the lesson to be terrified of Machloikis of the time the Titan can get out of hand. Well, the Titan can get out of hand, okay? And it reminded me, the whole pian of this, I have in front of me a rusty, trusty book I picked up in Israel maybe 30 years ago or more, because I had the kudos, you know me. And it's a bunch of essays from Rav Kook. And in his way, he idealizes Eretz Yisrael, obviously. Again, he idealizes Eretz Yisrael. And the Yerushalmi over the Bavli, even though we're well aware that we paskin like the Bavli. And he uses this example that I just told you about from Zerub to bring out the point that, you know, in Eretz Yisrael, the Avira and all the rest of it facilitated a more straightforward and less complicated and less shtachy approach to Shas and to Torah, and therefore was better, and that's where Abzera fell in love with it. I mean, that's the way he presented. And it goes on and on, especially, by the way, in the area of Agadato, where he likes the, many people like the Agadato. There's a certain Mahalach. They like the Agadatos and the Yerushalmi better than the Bavli. And Derek Akiv goes into the whole point of how important Agadata is. I'll talk about it another time. I don't want to do that now. But because that'll take us too far afield. But isn't it interesting that, like I said before, you find Reb Zeira saying, I want to be part of this. And if I can't fight, let me at least fast. You see? And let me daven fasting. So as I'll, by fasting and always being in pain, I'll be able to concentrate the mind. That's what I assumed the case was. And bring it out. And bring it out. I would make one or two more points. We have Elisha ben Avui over here who says, what's the lashon over here? And I think this is very interesting. Again, that isn't just, I'm speculating, but I think we know enough about it that it makes a little bit of sense. And that is, Halomed Yelad, what you learn in young, as they call tabula rasa, you have a clean slate, so it sticks in your mind. What you learn when you're young stick with you. When you learn when you're old, it doesn't stick with you. Because as he said over here, it's like dio, it's like ink on a paper that's already been erased. So this is in the old days where you wrote on ink and then you had to erase it, which means you mess up the paper and they rewrite it. It looks tarnished and not clear, and probably holes in it and tattered. And isn't it interesting that Elisha ben Avuya Acher would say this? And I'm just asking myself, on the one hand, they call him Elisha ben Avuya. So that sounds like something he said before he converted. You hear what I said? Converted. According to Yerushalmi and Chagiga, he converted to paganism. On the other hand, it could be not, because there are just as many stories, even in the Yerushalmi Chagiga, which blasts him, which talks about the fact, as you and I know, the Rabbi Meir was Makarev, tried his best to bring him back to Yiddishkeit. There are many stories along these lines, I'm sure you're familiar with. And you kind of get the impression that Acher, who said, Shuvu banim shom chutz mi Acher, that I'm beyond Shuvah, I've gone too far. And maybe he had. And Rabbi Meir kept saying, no, you haven't gone too far, as you know the story very well. So let me put it this way. Even when he was off the derech, he remembered a lot of what he learned. And you have all these stories of him telling Rav Meir, you know, no, that's not the way it is. This is the way it is. Or this is how we learned it when I was young and all the rest of it. In which case, he might be talking to Rav Meir and saying, well, you're trying to learn from, now I'm an old man. And Acher, if the stories we follow are true, seems to have died a kind of a bitter old man. And I get the impression, me, myself, and I, that it's a little bit like somebody, a Jew who, let's say, for example, is a communist, of which there are plenty. Then the Soviet Union, the whole communism collapsed. Syria was the guy who's most of an effort for communism. Really, sincerely. And history proved that he was wrong. Right? By the 1990s, everybody saw communism was a failure. So what did you spend your whole life on? You're worshiping a false god. Didn't exist. The god that failed, as Arthur Kessler called it. How do you feel? It's a bitterness. Now, nobody's physically torturing you, but it's a certain mental torture. This is what I waste all my time on. As best as we can see, Acher was a character and a victim in the Hadrianic persecutions of the 130s CE. And, you know, after the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. And for a year or two or three or however long it was a reign of terror, and that's what he killed. Sorry, Rugi Malchus, many of them, and so forth, as you know. But what happened afterwards? Eventually, the persecution stopped. Who was it? Antoninus Pius became the emperor, and they stopped. They stopped. Okay. And then what? And then life went back to normal. And here's a guy who was most of nefesh for paganism, and he was fingering people learning Torah. So I want you to think about this. There was a time when if you said somebody's learning Torah or running yeshiva, those people would get killed. And you went ahead and fingered them and told the police on them. And then later things changed and it was okay to have a yeshiva and to have rabbinical activity. That's what happened. In the wake, after the death of Hadrian, which was a couple years after Bar Kokhba, it wasn't long, the next Roman emperor or two, it's not 100% clear, abolished all this stuff. And what was totally life-threatening then wasn't. Mamish, what happened in Russia? When I was in Russia, and you know, in the most of the 20th century, seriously, if somebody would try to learn Torah or something like that, especially give classes, get in big trouble. And then all of a sudden it wasn't in the 1990s. And down till today, even under Putin. If you want to have a yeshiva, can have a yeshiva, provided you don't mess with the Russian politics and all that. And what was, a capital crime wasn't a crime. So how does somebody feel if they were a stool pigeon for the Romans or the Russians or whatever, and now the thing you were stool pigeon on, it doesn't even matter anymore. You feel like a jerk. And I think I see traces of this when he says the difference between you learning young, what you learn young, what you learn old, and when you're old, it's like learning on messed up paper and all the rest of it. It's not simply an exercise in memory, and that what you learn young, you memorize better and all the rest of it. That's a truism also. But why would Elisha ben Avuya of all people say, and why would they quote him on this? Unless it seems to me, I'm just speculating, obviously, but I think it's true. Libby Umerly, let's put it that way, that this is very much fitting a person who, as they say, kind of history passed him by. And here's her mayor trying to bring him back to Yiddishkeit and all the rest of it. And he's saying, you know, what you learn when you're a yellow, it's brand new and it sticks in your mind. When you learn when you're old, it's old. And I'm too old to learn. Right? I'm too old to learn. Because it's on Niyar Malchuk. So, don't try to do it. Rabbi Meir obviously said like this. It's not true. What you learn in your old age also counts. And there's the same Rabbi Kiva. But Bogers Raz Rechob Al-Tanav Yendecha. You don't know which. Which learning will stick with you. It's not necessarily true that what you learn when you're 15 or 20 is going to stick with you, and what you learn when you're 65 is not going to stick with you. It might be the other way around. You don't know. And so you see a little bit of, I would suggest, the human tragedy playing itself out in what sounds like a pedagogical kind of exercise, what you learn old and what you learn young. Libby Umerly, that they can't just have this Elisha ben Avuya being the one saying this. It's just sort of like a coincidence. I went a little bit too late. I'll just throw this out to start you and give you an appetite, and maybe we'll attack this next time. Who's the one who says there are three crowns and the most important crown is the Keser Shem Tov? There's Keser Melucha, Keser Kahuna, Keser Torah. There's the crown of kingship and of priesthood and learning. Oh, and if you're yeshivish, the Keser Torah should be the biggest, right? Oh boy, it is today. And then he says, no, the Keser Shem Tov is bigger than the Keser Torah. Which means it's harder to live a blameless life, as I always say, than to finish Shas. Who's the one who says it? Shin ben Yochai, Reb Shimon. Isn't that interesting? Now, how would you connect Reb Shimon, Shimon Yochai, with the idea that the Keser Shem Tov is higher than the Keser of the Torah? But that I'll leave to you, previews for coming attractions. Again, as always, I want to thank, because it's a little bit late now, it went a little bit too long. Let me, as always, thank Mishpacha Stefanski. And with that, I wish you a good week.